Your guide to Merseyside sport. The Kickoff.
Radio City Talk.
Let's focus now on a brand new Liverpool book. And of course, the club is celebrating its 125th anniversary. So 1892 to 2017. And virtually everything that there is to know about the club has been written. Well, at least you thought that, didn't you? Until you see this book, because this is the alternative history. So we've all seen the books that go through the games, the goals, the scorers, the highs. Now we've got a book which gives you stories which perhaps you've never heard before. And the man who's dug them out, or at least some of them, is Chris McLaughlin. Morning to you, Chris.
Morning, Steve. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so how do you write a different book about Liverpool Football Club and its 125 years?
It's difficult because you can't rewrite history, but what we did was try to dig out some of the stories, the lesser stories or stories about lesser players that maybe people don't know. The nature of the book obviously means that all the people you have heard of are in it, you know, so there are Bill Shankly stories, there are Bob Paisley stories, Stevie G, Luis Suarez, but from different angles and told in different ways. So I'll just give you an example. Instead of telling Steven Gerrard's career story, we told the story behind the men who coached him, Hughie McCauley and Dave Shannon, and yes, how a phone call led to him coming to the academy and all the rest of it. So it's presenting stories about players you know and you saw in the flesh and you loved watching from a different angle.
So much you could talk about Liverpool Football Club, isn't it? You've obviously spent your working career working around the club, as has Dave Cottrell, John Hines as well, and William Hughes, and they're sort of the co-authors in this book. So between the four of you, there's a fair bit you could concentrate on. I've just picked out various bits of the book, so tell me whether or not you do know the chapters in detail. Reds on tour. So, of course, Liverpool very famous for going on tours, wherever it might be around the world. But Liverpool's very first overseas tour, believe it or not, was 1914. Would you believe you go back that far? And they set sail. So they went on a boat to Sweden and Denmark. I can't imagine the players were over the moon.
It must have took a while to get there. it's not one of the stories I actually wrote, that one, but within that chapter, there is a good story about the tour to America before the 1946-47 season, when it was obviously after the war and wartime football was finishing and the Football League was starting again. And a lot of the players were malnourished. Obviously, there was rationing in the UK at the time. So the club took the players to America for the summer to eat, not just to play football, but to eat steak, to eat bread, to eat protein.
To build them up again.
To build them up again. When they come back, they were fitter than everybody else in the league and ended up winning the title that season. They were surprise winners. Nobody thought they would be based on what they'd done before the war. And a lot of it was down to the pre-season they had and how important that was to actually build themselves up physically.
How intelligent is that? It was to actually have the idea of taking them across the Atlantic just to get them nourished.
It was different, and it was something that, you know, Liverpool had become renowned for, doing things their own way, the Liverpool way, in a different way, and it gave them advantage. And, you know, I think we've seen that through the years where Shankly would do anything he could to give an advantage. Rafa, another story in there about Rafa, his attention to detail didn't actually work, but when they went to the World Club Championship in Japan after they won the European Cup in 2005, when they arrived in the country, he handed all the players sunglasses, sat them on the team coach and drew the curtains. You wouldn't let them look outside because he'd worked out somehow that the light in Japan was harsher on the players' eyes than it is in England. So we wanted them to acclimatise to the conditions they were going to be playing in.
Only Rafa could have decided the light was harsher. Right, you'll never walk alone. It's such a fundamental part of Liverpool Football Club, isn't it? Does everyone know the background to You'll Never Walk Alone? What have you found out that's different?
I mean, obviously, people know the story of Never Walk Alone coming from Carousel and how it was recorded by Jerry and the Pacemakers. I guess what people might not know is why it was played at Anfield in the first place. It was simply because it was in the charts, it was by a Liverpool band, and obviously the Kop sung along to it at half-time. I think there was a game against Fulham around that time, 1964, that the fans started singing along to. And then when it wasn't played over the PA system before kick-off, you know, after it dropped down the hit parade, as I think it might have been called at the time, the Kop started singing it anyway. So all of a sudden it came back on and it became Liverpool's unofficial anthem. That's now synonymous with the club, really. It's an official anthem.
So you put here, in November, the Reds hosted Fulham and Burnley in Division 1 fixtures. As You'll Never Walk Alone was number one, it was played closest to kickoff, and it inspired the Reds to 2-0 wins in both games as Shankly's side took further steps towards winning the championship. I have to say, I didn't realise it went to number one.
Yes, apparently yeah. So. I mean, I wasn't around at the time. I'm only a child of 1977. But you have to remember,
it was a top 10 hit.
It was a top 10 hit. And you have to remember the Kop would sing along to whatever was out at the time before kick-off and at half-time. There's that famous panorama footage, something that we've mentioned in the book, of the Kop sing along to Cilla Black. Now, if you look at the modern-day equivalent, you couldn't really imagine the Kop sing along to Adele at half-time or One Direction or something like that. So it was just a time and a place where everybody was in the ground, because you had to get in the ground early to get your spec. There was no pre-match entertainment. There wasn't even a warm-up at that time. So they just sing along to what was being played over the PA system.
You sort of fear you'll never see that again, will you? It'll never return in that sort of manner.
Not in that sense, but I do remember at half-time in the Europa League final in 2016 in Bale, when they played the Lars, There She Goes, over the PA system. And down at one end of the ground, you could hear all the Liverpool fans singing along. So to me, that's the closest we've had to that in the modern day, but I don't think it ever happened at Anfield.
They're special moments. Right, Stevie Nicol. And of course, he did a book recently with a lot of his funny stories in, 5 league titles and a packet of crisps. It's still on sale there. Always the butt of practical jokes as well as inflicting them himself.
Yeah, a bit of both. I mean, there's probably not been a footballer at Liverpool who's had more practical jokes played on him. There's a lot of famous ones, being left at motorway service station for fake boot deals. One that we've put in the book is the story how they convinced him that Kenny Dalglish was terminally ill. So he was, which sounds crazy now, doesn't it? Like that type of thing would happen. They convinced him he was ill, so he went to see Kenny in his room, and he was, you know, a bit upset. And he famously said, "Do you know what? This does explain why you've been playing so badly."
Can you imagine what Kenny's response must have been to that?
I think they all fell about laughing. There's some good stories from the 80s. For instance, the 1984 European Cup final. They went to Tel Aviv in Israel to play in a friendly before it. But they basically spent a week drinking over there and all got stuck in a lift in a hotel. And when, I think it was Alan Hansen, was like, he shouted for Souness and Kenny to come down to try and help get the other lads out. All they could hear was the lads singing Suicide is Pain, which is the theme tune from MASH, inside this lift in Tel Aviv. You know, a couple of days later, they went off to Roma and won the European Cup.
It's crazy just, days. It just and, of course, crazy. Sang in the tunnel as well, didn't they? I was chuckling away. I've heard the Paul Walsh story before, but it still is funny, isn't it? The famous sort of treatment story. He tells it. Have you ever seen him doing an after dinner? Just recount it for us.
But, I mean, basically, it probably goes back to further than that, when Jimmy Melia was actually playing for Liverpool and they got this new sort of electronic equipment to try and, I don't know how you describe it, but it sends vibration pulses through your leg. And it wouldn't work, and the turning up, Bob Paisley turns it up to full blast, it wasn't happening. And then somebody says, "Oh, you've not plugged it in." They plug it in, and of course, it's on full blast, and Jimmy Melia literally leapt out of his chair and pretty much leapt out of the stadium, I think. Paul Walsh, again, he was getting treated. I've forgotten the actual nature of the injury, but again, the equipment didn't work. It wasn't on, and he was having repeated training
for a few months.
For a few months, rehabilitation sessions with a piece of equipment that was never working.
How physiotherapy has changed over the years. Right, something that's important to me, obviously, is broadcasting and hosting. And there's a chapter here on the voice of Anfield, George Sefton. When did George very first make his debut? Here we go. August 1971 was his third match as public address announcer at Anfield. That is how long George has been going.
I've never been to a game in Anfield where George has not been there, and I've been going since 1987. He is as much as part of the Anfield matched experience, as people call it now, as anything is. And I think his actual first game was Kevin Keegan's debut back in 71, if I remember rightly, against Nottingham Forest. And he is synonymous with Anfield and just his sort of dulcet tones and the way he announces substitutions and all the rest of it, really. I couldn't imagine going to a match without George being there.
It says here, less than a fortnight earlier, George made his bow as the club's PA announcer, but he will be remembered for another notable Anfield debut, Kevin Keegan, stealing the show.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not a bad way to start, is it, when you've got a player like Kevin Keegan coming and scoring his debut against Forest. And George must have seen more matches than most other people who still go to Anfield on a regular basis. I mean, you know, there are guys who have been going for longer, but the amount of football he has seen, the success he's seen, is quite phenomenal, really.
Is he the longest-running PA announcer in the Premier League?
As far as I know, he is.
Got to be, hasn't he?
The guy at Fulham, whose name I've completely forgotten, has been there for quite a long time.
The DJ.
The DJ. You know what I mean? I can't think of his name.
Davey Hamilton.
Diddy Davey Hamilton. I think he's been at Craven Cottage for a long time, but I don't think he's been there since 1971.
Oh, George is a bit of a legend. Right, The Kid Who Would Be King is another of these chapters here. Look, there's 125 of them, so I'm not ruining it for you. But you've written about Kenny Dalglish here and the transfer to Liverpool.
Yeah, and Kenny actually came down when Bill Shankly was in charge for a trial and actually didn't end up making it at Liverpool. I think the story in that book, it's not one I've written, is how in the trial game he was about to score and somebody nicked the ball off his feet and scored instead, or something along those lines. So he didn't get quite as noticed. But Kenny sort of admits he wasn't quite ready to make the move down from Glasgow at that time. It actually obviously worked out better that he came when he did, because I guess if Kenny had come early, we'd never have had Keegan and history would have been different.
Completely. Let me just pick out another one here. All I did was literally flick through and find out some sensational stuff about different figures. We know young Bob Paisley. 75 years ago, probably the last thing on Bob Paisley's mind was football. Now, we all know Bob's sort of history with the army and the stories about Roman 1977 and what he said to the players. Last time I was here, I was in a tank fighting the Germans. It's quite amusing, really, isn't it?
But Bob's story is remarkable, really, when you think about it. He came down as a player from, you know, a little-known club in Bishop Auckland, really, that most Liverpool supporters wouldn't have heard of. Came down to Liverpool. Matt Busby helped him out when he was here, sort of took him under his wing. And he basically went from playing to being the most successful manager we've ever had. And in between, served in the army. Now, if you look at someone, if I look at that from my point of view, someone who's not lived through a war and all the rest of it, you look at that on paper, it seems like a crazy thing to actually happen to a young lad moving down from the North East just to play a bit of football.
Phenomenal achievement, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there won't be another English manager ever wins three European Cups. You know, there's not many English managers in the game. For what Bob actually achieved is completely underrated.
I bet there was some, I mean, I've heard them from the former players, but there are some hilarious stories, aren't there, about how Bob used to conduct himself. Some are a little bit conflicting. Some say he walked in with one shoe, one slipper.
Copy the Racing Post under his arm. He'd call people Dougie Doings because he couldn't remember the name.
Yeah.
He'd say things like, he's not quick, he's nippy. But they knew what he meant. Yeah. Even though he didn't maybe have the greatest grasp of the English language and his communication methods were different to what you'd be used to from a manager now, it worked. The players understood. They were organised. They knew his tactics. They played for him. They liked him. And they got results.
But the one thing he couldn't do, as you say, was communicate well in terms of a personality approach or a personable approach. So, for example, when he had to leave a David Johnson out of a cup final or a David Fairclough, he wasn't someone who could make them understand why he did it. In fact, he didn't even go as far as trying to make them understand.
No, I think he was quite a hard taskmaster in that way, in that he obviously was left out of a cup final himself back in 1950, I think it was, the Arsenal game. So it was something he'd experienced before and he would remember the pain of that and the emotion of that. But then couldn't communicate it to his players in a sort of arm around the shoulder way, say like Jürgen Klopp might do now. You know, if you look at Klopp, he's hugging everyone, he shakes hands with everyone, he clearly tells the players what he thinks. He's almost like a friend to them at times, but he's also the boss. Paisley was not like that at all.
Probably just left it to Roy to sort it out, didn't he, at the time?
Joe Fagan as well, I think, did a lot of that.
Right, did you write this one? By the way, your champions heard the one about the Liverpool side who had to be informed by a teammate that they've been crowned league champions?
No, this is one of Will Hughes' stories. Will covers Liverpool ladies for us. And when they won their first Premier League title a few years back, they were awaiting the result from another game. I can't remember if it was Chelsea involved now, to be honest. It wasn't a game I was at. And they didn't know if they'd won it. They'd come off the pitch, they'd got the result they wanted, and they had no idea if they were champions or not. So literally somebody shouted across to them, oh, by the way, you've won the league. Which, you know, on these days, professional football, the men's game, it'd be on Sky Sports, it'd be on Twitter, it'd be all, everybody would know what was happening. There'd be live updates. They didn't know. They'd just somebody shouted over, oh, yeah, you've won the league.
That reminds me of the Alaves game in 2001, when actually I think the majority of the players, if not all of them, didn't actually understand that they were playing a golden goal rule in the final. And I was there commentating with Alan Irwin. I didn't actually understand either.
No, and people don't always understand the rules of the new modern-day penalty shootouts, do they? This sort of, you take the first one, the next team takes the next two. The way the rules have changed. And I was at the game as well in Alaves, and one of the pieces we've done in the books about Delphi Gelly, who's one of sort of Liverpool's unsung heroes, and they actually scored the winner. He was an own goal, wasn't it, off Gary McAllister's free kick. And I kind of managed to find out where he is now. He's the president of a small Spanish club called Girona. So he's still actually in the game. And I don't think he particularly likes doing interviews about the 2001 UEFA Cup final. But he has his place in Liverpool folklore. And he kind of suits the book.
What's his name again?
Delphi Gelly. He was a centre-half, Spanish centre-half. He was playing for Alaves at the time. I mean, it was a remarkable achievement for a little club like that to actually get to the UEFA Cup final.
Oh, they should have been written off before the game.
Absolutely, but he kept winning. I mean, I think in the semi-final they beat Kaiserslautern about 10-2 on aggregate or something like that, and they give Liverpool a right game that night in Dortmund.
Right, talking about scoring a lot of goals, there's a story in here about someone who scored a heck of a lot, but actually never made it.
A lot of people probably remember Alan Bleasdale, playwriter. His brother Terry actually played for Liverpool's youth team, but he never made it at Liverpool. He never made a first team appearance. However, in a youth game, he actually scored 18 goals in a 19-0 win. Which is phenomenal. But it shows.
Can't be true. It
shows you the talent Shankly had at the time. I mean, he's got a guy scoring 18, kids scoring 18 goals in one game. Never gets a look in.
18 goals.
It's a story to tell the grandkids about, and not a lot of people knew it, but we kind of managed to uncover it. Dave Cottrell spoke to him, and he was quite shocked that we'd managed to find out about it. And obviously, we've put it in the book, and now he's going to have a little bit of fame in that. He was the man who scored 18 goals and never played for Liverpool.
Well, that's the thing. The worst thing is, he's never got anywhere after that high.
No, but he's always
peaked
got that.
Too soon.
He peaked far too soon. He's got an 18 in one game as a youth team.
Which is your favourite story in all of it?
I loved writing the stuff about the Grand National, to be honest. I did a piece about all the Liverpool games that were clashed with Grand National, and some of the things around, for instance, the board of directors was so concerned about the effect on attendances when the Grand National got moved to a Saturday after the war. It used to always be on a Friday until the 1940s, because a lot of Liverpool fans were going to Aintree instead of going to the match. So they started playing Friday night football at Anfield. So a lot of people think Friday night football started as a TV thing. It didn't. It actually started because of the Grand National. And one year, 1950s, they took a chance and played, they kept the game on a Saturday against Charlton Athletic. 17,000 people who'd been to the previous game didn't turn up, went to Aintree instead. And it just shows to me how important that event is, the sporting event, the Grand National is at Liverpool. It was something the whole city would go to. And still do, obviously, the Thursday, Friday and the Saturday now. But it actually directly affected the attendance at Anfield. And now Liverpool never play at home on Grand National Day.
Huge event on the calendar. Remember, of course, the Merseyside Derby on Grand National Day in 75-76, wasn't it?
It's David Fairclough.
Yeah, so Fairclough with his goal. And, of course, Phil Neal gets the penalty at the end and misses it.
Absolutely.
Gives Fairclough all the headlines. But was that an 11 o'clock kickoff?
I think
kick-off?
It was an 11 o'clock kickoff. And a lot of the games were moved early, and then the players would then actually go to Aintree and watch the race themselves.
To suit everyone.
Absolutely. It was perfect. Liverpool win, and you get the win of the Grand National. That would have been a good Saturday.
Chris, that's right up your street, isn't it? The only thing to top that would be a rugby league match at the very end of the day.
I think I'd need all three, really. I'd need Liverpool the early kickoff, picking the Grand National win, and then Saints win the grand final that night. It'd be
very
ideal.
And a beer at the very end of it all. The book's brilliant. Honestly, if you get this for someone for Christmas, just loads of stuff that's quite funny or stuff you've never heard in it before. It's 125 years of Liverpool Football Club, but it's the alternative history. And of course, Chris has just detailed more than a handful of stories, but there's loads more in there that'll make you laugh or just stuff that'll surprise you you've never seen before. Where can you get your hands on it?
Sportmediashop.com is the best place to go, but obviously Amazon and all the usual bookshops in town. It's on sale everywhere.
And it looks so glossy. It's one of those things, if you handed me that for Christmas, I'd go, oof, that looks amazing. Well, whoever did the cover, well done to
family
you.
Know what to get you now, don't they, Steve?
Your guide to Merseyside sport. Kickoff.
Radio City Talk.